As the world experiences an unprecedented burst in warming with extraordinary events that have shocked scientists, it's become clear that mitigation alone, that is, reducing fossil fuels to zero, is not in itself sufficient to deliver a safe climate and protect the world's peoples and ecosystems. Nowhere is that clearer than at the poles, where global heating is at its fastest.
That is David Spratt, the research director with Melbourne's Breakthrough Organisation, speaking at the opening session, the Climate Cooling Mini Summit, a part of the Melbourne-based National Sustainability Living Festival. Yes, welcome to this latest episode of Climate Conversations. I'm your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. Let's listen now to David as he talks with two Finnish guests about climate cooling and activism. As this was the opening session of the Mini Cooling Summit, David explains how the whole program will operate.
Hello and welcome to the Climate Cooling Mini Summit, an event of the National Sustainability Festival. This event is proudly supported by the Breakthrough National Centre for Climate Restoration, the Climate Rescue Accord, and the Council and Community Action in the Climate Emergency. This afternoon's event comprises three sessions. The one now is on global cooling. At 2:15, we're having Australia's Climate Accord on political parties who are working on a climate rescue platform to stop and reverse global heating. And after a short break at 3:15, we'll have Reclaiming the Climate Emergency Locally. How can we accelerate levels by all actions of government to reverse warming? Our opening session is on climate cooling and activism, a very different climate conversation, with two members of the Finnish youth organisation Operaatio Arktis and their campaign for climate repair to protect the Arctic. And we particularly thank them for joining us at 4 o'clock in the morning, 4 a.m. their time. So this session is brought to you by the Breakthrough National Centre for Climate Restoration. I'm David Spratt, Research Director for Breakthrough, and I'll be your host for the first session until 2 o'clock. This event is coming to you from Melbourne, Australia, the land of the Wurundjeri people, part of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and recognise that this land was never ceded. As the world experiences an unprecedented burst in warming with extraordinary events that have shocked scientists, it's become clear that mitigation alone, that is, reducing fossil fuels to zero, is not in itself sufficient to deliver a safe climate and protect the world's peoples and ecosystems. Nowhere is that clearer than at the poles, where global heating is at its fastest. So before we talk to Annie and Anton from Operation Arctic in English about their vision and their work, let's have a quick look at what's happening over the last year and the lessons it contained. Climate disruption and climate repair. So last year, scientists were astounded by what happened in the climate system. Words like astounding, staggering, unnerving, bewildering. Others said we are hitting records, record-breaking extremes much sooner than I expected. That's frightening, scary, and concerning. That was Sarah Perkins Kirkpatrick from the University of New South Wales. And it's so far out of anything we've seen, it's almost mind-blowing. So last year, as you can see in the diagram at right, the black line, warming was mind-blowing. It was the first year where warming reached 1.5 degrees over the pre-industrial level. In fact, the last 80 days, the last half a year, has been 1.7 degrees of average warming. And perhaps the most spectacular figure was in September last year, when it broke the previous record by a full half a degree. And in all the records that were broken, two of the most astounding were sea surface temperatures and Arctic sea ice loss, which were way beyond what scientists had projected. So Jim Hansen, James Hansen, the former great head of climate science for NASA, says we are very close to a warming degree trend. If you look at the diagram on right, that yellow band that he projected perhaps a year ago is actually where we're heading. He says the warming is accelerating, that effectively we've reached 1.5, we'll probably be at 1.7 by the end of this decade, 2030, and by 2 degrees by the late 2030s, which is, you know, way ahead of what people thought even 5 or 10 years ago. So now there's widespread recognition that the rate of warming is accelerating. So the new head of the World Meteorological Organization said the rate of human-caused climate change is accelerating, but, and I quote, we are not there in terms of our scientific understanding of the implications of this acceleration. That is, scientists cannot yet fully explain what happened last year and where we are. But what we do know, if we look at the lower diagram, which is Earth's energy imbalance, which is a measure of the amount of incoming radiation versus outgoing radiation. And we can see as we go towards the right that that is lifting up higher and higher. So the Earth's imbalance is getting larger in quantity, and that's a good indicator of future warming. So where are we going? A few years ago, some of the world's leading scientists produced a thumbnail called The Carbon Law, in which they said, if you want to hold warming to 2 degrees, and obviously 2 degrees is not altogether safe, you would have to drop emissions by half every decade, from 2020 to 2030 by half, and again from 2030 to 2040, and so on. Holding warming to 2 degrees necessitated halving emissions each decade, they said. But in reality, if we look at what's happening around the world, and these are figures from the production gap report from the United Nations last year, we can see that coal is projected to go down, but the other two, oil and gas, are projected to go up. So this is an analysis based on what countries say they are going to do in terms of their investment in new fossil fuels. So greenhouse gases and coal hit record in 2023, and gas and oil producers plan to keep on expanding production. And that includes the world's largest 5 fossil fuel emissions, that is the United States, China, Russia, Saudi Arabia, and unfortunately, Australia. So when you put that together and you look at where global emissions will be in 2050, looking at the red line here, on current government policies, we can see that in 2050, emissions will be 5, 10% at most lower than they are. That may change if governments do more, but at the moment, we are heading towards emissions being as high in 2050 as they are today. And of course, that means that we are going to fly past 2 degrees. When we think about these risks, the most important thing is to understand that we have to look at the worst case possibilities. What is the plausible worst things that can happen? Because that is where the damage is greatest at the high end. And that's what governments have failed to do. They are looking at the averages rather than the high end possibilities. So where are we heading? Look, scientists I talk to all have a 3. They say we're heading towards 3 degrees or more, given the lack of action, those continuing high emissions. And it may be a good deal more because of the reinforcing feedbacks in the system. So the preeminent UK think Chatham House a couple of years ago said a plausible worst case scenario is perhaps 3.5 degrees or more, but this could be an underestimate if tipping points are reached sooner than the orthodox science suggests, which is now actually what's happening. So unfortunately, that's where we're heading. And a survey 3 years ago of IPCC scientists asked where we were going. And you can see that long orange red line. The majority, almost half, said 3 degrees, and more than 60%, almost 65%, 3 degrees or more. And 82% said they thought warming would be catastrophic in our lifetime. So that, unfortunately, is the picture of where we are. Is this a civilizational threat? I think the world's leading and most eminent scientists are now all saying yes. Professor Tim Lenton, who's done a lot of that work on tipping points and climate boundaries last year, said, if we carry on the way we are now, I can't see this civilization lasting to the end of this century. And I think that's a fairly frank view that is widespread amongst scientists, even if a lot of them are not so keen to say it publicly. And one great example of that is all the work that's been done on extreme heat. So here's an image, and you can see in the shaded areas, regions which by 2.7 degrees, so we're looking at about 2055, 2060, perhaps 40 years from now, regions that will have heat that humans have never previously experienced, which is more or less saying regions where people would not be able to survive in the heat of summer without air conditioning and artificial means. And you can see it covers the top quarter of Australia, a good bit of Southeast Asia, particularly Indonesia and Thailand, across to India and Pakistan, of course, right through the Middle East, sub-Saharan Africa, and perhaps saddest of all, a large part of the Amazon. So this is the desertification and the drying that will come on the present trajectory. One third of the planet around the equatorial regions will be uninhabitable, says Johan Rockström, one of the leading experts on tipping points. To emphasise that, Chatham House 3 years ago did a report, and they said that by 2040, 2050, unless emissions rapidly decline, and they are not at the moment, we could expect food demand to increase 50% over the next 30 years, but there would be a 30% drop in crop yields. Now, that equation simply doesn't have an answer except the one that they gave, which these cascading impacts will drive to, and I think this is understated, political instability, greater national insecurity, and regional and international conflict, that is, breakdown. So many scientists are now saying, because this is the normative question that large parts of the climate movement never ask, is where do we need to go to preserve our planet, to preserve our vital ecosystems? And Andrew King from the University of Melbourne says, from a long-term perspective, a justifiable aim is a future climate akin to pre-industrial conditions. John Schellenhuber, the former director of Potsdam Institute, says our survival would depend very much on how well we're able to draw down back to pre-industrial levels. That is, leading scientists are saying it is important to cool the climate back to where we came from in the mid-19th century. So to get to the nub of today's question, which is cooling, what do we need to do? On the current path, emissions are going to go up and up and up, as is illustrated. There's obviously a danger level up on the y-axis of increasing impacts and temperature, and there's a level for cascading impacts. And I think that dotted line is perhaps where we are now, because we can already see that we are past certain tipping points and that things are really escalating, even talking about slowdown of the Atlantic circulation. Obviously, going to emissions fast can bend that impacts and curve down a lot, but not below the dotted line by itself. Obviously, with large drawdown, taking CO2 out of the atmosphere, we can get back to a safe level, but that is going to take time, perhaps the rest of this century, because drawdown is a relatively slow process. And so the conclusion we come to is that some form of active cooling, trying now to cool vital ecosystems and or the planet to stop those tipping points and that moving into a hot house or unstoppable warming is now an option we need to think about. The drawdown options are many, whether they're nature-based solutions like reforestation, ecosystems, sequestration and so on, technical solutions like negative emissions construction using wood rather than concrete. And then, of course, there are a number of cooling options which you'll be talking to with Anton and Ani, including mirrors, cloud brightening, solar reflection, and so on. So the crucial messages in all of this is that we need zero emissions really fast. The Earth is already too hot, so we need drawdown. Damage is and will become dangerous before long-term solutions and mitigation are effective. So we need safe means of immediate cooling to protect people and nature. And I'll just finish with some of the work that Anton and Anna and their group have been doing. Some really important statements. Climate repair means deliberate measures taken to prevent negative consequences of global warming. And I think this is really important, that can no longer be prevented with certainty through emissions reductions alone. The second point, even staying at 1.5 degrees does not guarantee a stable climate. Thirdly, in terms of the Arctic, which is where their priority is, the most promising technologies are marine cloud brightening and aerosol injection, which we'll talk about. Fourthly, there are knowledge gaps, but there are risks in acting, but also risks in not acting and not knowing, and that climate repair research has to be conducted today and not tomorrow. So that's the end of the presentation, and it's my great pleasure to welcome our guests, Anni Pokala and Anton Keskinen, who are two of the founders of the Finnish advocacy organisation Operaatio Arktis. Anni is the project manager and Anton is the head of strategy. They're doing some really interesting things that are different from most climate activists and advocacy groups. So let's start with the beginning of AO. Annie, apologies again for the early hour, but I understand that some of you have been were involved in XR Finland and that you were students at the University of Helsinki. So what was it that led you into this idea that sparked the formation of AO?
Yeah, thank you, David, and thanks for having us here. We essentially like a group of friends who originally got to know each other by organizing civil disobedience campaigns in Extinction Rebellion Finland. So we were trying to get the Finnish government to state or make like a statement of a climate emergency in Finland and get the government to reduce emissions a lot quicker than they're doing right now. And after what was like our biggest mobilization success in XR a couple of years back, we decided to kind of take a step back and look at the science and look at especially what was happening in the Arctic area. And it was a lot worse than we thought. Turns out that there's kind of like the Arctic climate system that's already starting to collapse in ways that we can't stop anymore by just reducing emissions. Or at least that's very likely. As young people, as people like, as you said in the presentation, like one of the quotes was that like this person can't see civilization maybe lasting to the end of the century. Like I'm supposed to be living in 2080s on paper. So I mean, we were horrified and we were like, okay, if there's any possible way of preventing this like Arctic climate catastrophe from happening, we should look into it. And so, yeah, we started looking into additional measures, talking to scientists and politicians and researchers about these techniques, and very soon realized that there is a really, really growing need for more research and for developing not only like these technologies, but the policy and governments around them as well.
So if we don't cool the Arctic in the right time frame, what happens to the Arctic?
There's a lot of like this, well, we talk about like the kind of vicious cycle of heating. So there's a lot of like, because the Arctic Ocean is covered with the sea ice, which is kind of sun blocking shield. Once that's gone, there's more dark surface, so more heat gets sucked into the area. Permafrost is going to melt, like land frozen, permanently frozen land that's been there for like crazy long times. It's gonna like thaw, which is gonna mean infrastructure just being destroyed. People's houses are gonna be washed into the sea. There's a huge threat to food safety, and what comes to that, there's like especially indigenous peoples are on the front lines of these impacts. Like the North Water Polynya is greatly under threat. So there's a lot of like these very existential threats that we're facing if we don't get the Arctic to cool down. And also like the Arctic climate system is like the thermostat for like the whole Earth's climate. So there's a lot of like extreme weather that we're probably going to face once the jet stream is going to slow down because of the heating. Yeah, a great many.
To talk about the canary in the coal, the canary in the coal mine. What starts in the Arctic doesn't stop in the Arctic.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It has very, very global effects. Yeah.
Thanks, Annie. So, Anton, one of your statements, which I read out briefly, climate repair means deliberate measures taken to prevent negative consequences of global warming that can no longer be prevented with certainty through emissions reductions alone. So what are the actual, in technical or direct terms, what are the actual ways of cooling the Arctic and repairing the Arctic?
Yeah, thanks, David, and thanks for having us. Well, I should say maybe the most kind of promising or Yeah, the most promising option would be to maybe spread some cooling aerosols in the stratosphere, like sulfate aerosols probably, which would then reduce the amount of incoming sunlight in that area, and of course then lower the surface temperatures. That's kind of the obvious one, and it's the most researched, I should say, and it's been demonstrated in many simulations to at least reduce the surface melt of Greenland ice sheet, but also it's shown to be able to preserve Arctic sea ice even under such scenarios where it would be lost otherwise, but also, yeah, for sure, to cool down the areas where there's a lot of permafrost. But then the other technique that's kind of suggested, a bit less studied for cooling the Arctic, would be marine cloud brightening. So basically you could try to make the marine clouds more reflective in the areas where there's a lot of heat transport towards the Arctic. So that would be like Northern Atlantic, maybe perhaps even in the area where Arctic Ocean connects to Pacific Ocean. And yeah, so you could try to cool down the ocean and air currents that are taking heat.
So this is essentially, without putting it too crudely, spraying water vapor at a certain size, which is really important in the atmosphere to boost the cloud cover and reduce the amount of incoming heat.
Yeah, that's right, and that's something that people in the Australia have already tried to do, or at least done some field studies in the hopes of preserving at least parts of the Great Barrier Reef that we know is kind of gone already. If there's no new measures, you know, that we would find.
So this is still at a research stage, but it is now not just research in the laboratory, but research in practice out in the real world.
That's right. And like practically, yeah, we know that aerosols affect clouds, of course, because clouds are like all of the clouds, every single droplet that you see is water vapor that's condensated around some small aerosol particle. And yeah, basically you could just, as you said, spread sea salt to create more smaller droplets in one cloud to make them brighter. And as you said, yeah, it's becoming like, yeah, some groups are starting to try to do it in practice already.
So the idea, if this would be work, is it would take enough heat out of the Arctic to stop the loss of the rest of the sea ice in summer, and also to stop or slow the disintegration of Greenland, which in itself could be a driver for the slowing or stopping of the Atlantic circulation, which is like the really big issue.
Yeah, that's the big issue now, and for good reasons, because that's like the end of the civilization if we get to the tipping point of the AMOC.
So Annie, we might come back to the technologies, but in terms of your advocacy and the politics, I know you've done a lot of work within Finland, talking to people in the political system. Have you had some success?
Good question. How to define success? I mean, in the sense, one thing that I would say is that when we started doing this work about 2 years ago, there was like no one that knew what climate repair meant. And that was like one of our like biggest things that we wanted to like do, is make people aware of the fact that it exists and is something that should be part of the climate discussion. So maybe our biggest thing that we did here like nationally is that we had like this first kind of international climate repair or climate intervention conference. It was like a big event in the city center, and it did get some attention, and it was a very big success all in all. But like these events and lobbying and things that we've done is kind of gone to a point where, like, compared to 2 years ago, like there are actually politicians with, you know, in like pretty major power positions that now know the term, that now know even like they have some tools to kind of take part in that discussion, which is really important. And there has been like we have had like a member of parliament that has now kind of taken the term and taking kind of a lot of interest in our work, who has done like a written question to our government that's right in power right now about Finland maybe perhaps like preparing itself to possibly maybe having to do some sort of climate repair, climate intervention at some point. So we have seen this term kind of slowly getting into the political discussions, and there are a lot of like, because we've done a lot of work, especially in like climate activist groups as well. So I think we have succeeded, at least in some way, in bringing that kind of that that vocabulary kind of forward. Yeah,
and I saw a video of you interviewed at COP 28. You all went to Abu Dhabi, the center of the fossil fuel world. I think several of you went. What was your experience there? I know you were working with some activists, including from Africa, who also want to talk about the need for climate repair research.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was like one of the biggest takeaways for me, at least at COP, was meeting all these young people from across the world who are like ready to discuss this and who are very much like very passionate about having these discussions and having research being done not only in the Arctic area, but in like their local communities as well. And a lot of interesting conversations with them and about like maybe like building this kind of network of young people from all over the world who are who really want to push this research forward, and also having discussions with people who are very skeptical towards climate interventions and who might be even against even researching any of these techniques. And yeah, it can be very difficult. Like, we did have some difficult conversations with people, but I at least got, you know, a lot of things out of those conversations as well, because it's really important to like not silence those people, but to bring them into the conversation as well and really hear them out, because usually they have a lot of good points about the risks as well. Yes.
Well, the question of risks was on my list of things to talk about, Anton. I mean, many of you put out a very good report called Arctic Endgame, which is on your website, which I would really encourage people to read. And in there, you had a section about risks, and you said risks are different for different groups, and risks are different for young people than they are for baby boomers like me. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. So what we tried to do there is to bring this new element into the idea of how to conduct risk analysis. As you have also talked about, risk analysis is that risks are the likelihood of outcome multiplied with the severity of the outcome. And I think that's true, that's correct. But what we tried to do there is to create this kind of new discussion about, well, this is kind of obvious, but risks are different for different people. For example, for my future kids, the risk of, you know, losing the AMOC in 2080 is like an actual risk for their livelihoods and life and future. As for people now making decisions about climate, like emissions or climate interventions or anything related to that, it's just theoretical thing. So I think that's kind of self-explanatory. Yeah.
So the risk or damage to you is materially much greater than the risk or damage for me.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you that's also right. Said because some of the greatest climate impacts, because climate impacts are also a function of the economic capacity to respond or to adapt. So in the developing world, where there is not the same economic capacity to adapt or to respond, the impact can be greater. So there's also an equity issue in risks.
Oh yes, absolutely. It's a huge one, and not just that, not just the economic opportunities or possibility to adapt, but also geography. It's a huge thing because, you know, if we think about tropics, it's mostly low-income countries in the tropics, and a lot of people live in the tropical areas or subtropical areas. That's most of the people in the world, and these areas are the ones that will you know, see the extreme heat waves. But also, when we think about sea level rise, it's going to be bigger in the tropics compared to, for example, in Finland or the southern parts of Australia, for example, because when the ice sheets are melting and losing ice by runoff and calving and stuff like that, their capability to pull stuff towards them, like the gravity of the ice sheets are getting smaller, which means that the water is going to rise more further away from them. So just the one example of how it's a lot more terrible situation for people in the global south.
You're with Climate Conversations, listening to a conversation from the Climate Cooling Mini Summit, which was a part of Melbourne's Sustainable Living Festival.
So Annie, in a sense, I mean, there's often a discussion, particularly from opponents of climate interventions, that you shouldn't do these things until you're absolutely certain. But I mean, there's also a risk in not acting, because warming is getting worse, and if you wait too long, the problem becomes more and more unsolvable. So you've talked about in your report about what I would call the price or risk of delay, of needing to act sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is one of the risks that we do want to remind people of, is that there are already people and places that are like researching these interventions and looking into even deploying them. So, and there are a lot of like expert researchers that say that some sort of climate intervention is probably going to be done at some point somewhere. So I think that's a risk as well, of like not being prepared and to get into a situation with the heating where people start to panic and start, you know, using these techniques or deploying them when they're not ready, when there is not proper governance, when it's the research or like the deployment is not done ethically. There can be like multiple, you know, there can be like international conflict that you know can arise from that sort of situation. So it's a question of preparing for that situations so that we can kind of you know have a informed opinion on maybe deploying them. And I there's a lot of like, yeah, I think our governments and like climate strategies worldwide, like they really lack that basic risk analysis of like, as you said, David, in your presentation, like the one problem is that the worst scenario is not being taken into account in the risks analysis. And yeah, I think some people are ready to kind of just dismiss climate interventions outright without really actually weighing the risks of using them to not using them. But also, yeah, we do lack the research kind of to really conduct a comprehensive risk analysis of especially like specific
it's a
techniques.
Dilemma. It's a dilemma. So Anton, in terms of where the technology is and the research is, I mean, how close are we and how close are scientists to saying we could actually deploy these things? I know with Marine Cloud Bright in there saying they're doing work, and I think it could be deployed in 4 or 5 years. So, I mean, we've got to balance the social and economic costs and the economic and social benefits. I mean, how far, if there were international agreements, how far away would you guess we could be from actually seeing this happen?
I have to give a bit complicated answer. So there's two factors here. I think one is the practical availability. So this means if we have the infrastructure, if we have the money, if we have the technology to do these interventions. And the other one is, when will the decision makers, would it be like governments or parliaments or whatever, when will these decision maker bodies believe that they have enough information to make the decision? And to the first question, well, some people have argued, for example, David Keith and the other guy, I don't remember the name, but they just put out an article 1 month ago, I think, where they said that even in 5 years, we could start, or someone could start, a small-scale deployment of SAI, which is stratospheric aerosol injection, by using these private jets to do that, because they can fly to 15 kilometers, and that would be enough in some areas of the world to reach this stratosphere. And sulfur, yeah, we know how to do that. So in 5 years, in theory, someone could start to do that. When it comes to marine cloud brightening, well, there is more uncertainty with the technology. So I don't think there is yet like enough capability to produce the optimal size of droplets. So to the other situation, or the other point, about when will decision makers believe they have enough information, that's something that will change over time. So we should avoid this idea of, or the thinking of, this kind of shopping list thinking, as Andy Parker from Decrease Initiative has put it, which means that typically we like to think that there's like 10 things or X amount of things that we need to know before we can decide whether to do climate intervention or not. But when we move forwards, and when climate impacts get worse, people's tolerance for uncertainty, but also for negative side effects, which could have been in the first place reduced by more research, that tolerance will get bigger. So people will like, you know, be more open to do more risky stuff with less information.
I think if we could talk about climate repair governance for another whole hour, but just before we go to questions and discussion from our audience, I know, and I mentioned in the presentation, James Hansen, perhaps sometimes called the godfather of modern climate science, and a man who really got me on this track. You've had some discussions with him, and he wants to do some sort of publication or paper with you, which is very exciting.
It is very exciting indeed. Yeah, we feel very honored about that. And we just get on call with him, and he suggested that, and for sure we're going to do it. So I think we are going to focus on the policy and climate intervention side, and he's going to do kind of like an update from the work he published last year, talking about the current situation with the Earth energy imbalance.
That's fabulous. That's a very big megaphone that he's got. On to some questions. The technical one to start with. Will recordings of this be available to watch afterwards? I'm asking Luke, and the answer is yes. The next question is from Stevie T, and I think you did talk about this in Arctic Endgame. How do you stop climate intervention being co-opted by people who want to continue business as usual?
So we can go deeper into the whole moral hazard argument or theory if we want, but short answer to that is by getting as much people on board, as much people to discuss this and create the public pressure. I think that's like in practical terms what we can do to get all of the civil society and academics and good people in politics to talk about it. So that's one way to try to prevent it.
You talked about sort of tying climate action to certain mitigation responsibilities. So you couldn't do one without doing the other. You sort of join them together. So you couldn't just continue emitting and doing this at the same time. We've got one question which I think is important. There's been a lot of talk recently because of research, and this is from Jane, about the slowdown of what's called the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, sometimes slightly incorrectly called the Gulf Stream, which is that part of a global deep ocean circulation that for Europe carries water from the Caribbean up into Northern Europe and makes agriculture possible. And there's research saying there is a point at which it could slow down. And I've seen Stefan Rahmstorf from Potsdam Institute, who's perhaps the world's leading figure in this, saying that he thinks the chance of it slowing to stopping this century is greater than 10%. And he said that's an enormous risk. So, I mean, in terms of Finland, you're right up in the northeast end of Europe. What does the stopping of AMOC mean for living in Northern Europe for you?
Well, it's the end of our society in the way that we've used to think about it. Sorry for laughing, but yeah, seriously, well, people are projecting temperature drops, but something like 15, even 20 degrees, even 30 degrees in some parts of Norway. So that's, yeah, I don't see agriculture happening in that situation. So yeah, so yeah, not just losing like warm summers, but losing everything.
I read somewhere that somebody said it meant the functional end of agriculture in Northern Europe, which is just such a frightening thing. And the great driver of that, to come back to the work you're doing, the great driver of the AMOC slowing down is increased melting off Greenland, where all this fresh water dumping off Greenland is slowing down the circulation. And that's why your Arctic repair program is actually the core to stopping the AMOC slowdown.
That's right. And that's why we've been also thinking about like trying to maybe make this as a issue of national security, even in Finland. Mm. That just real quick add, when you, David, said that you couldn't do climate interventions without also cutting emissions, I believe that's like ethically speaking, right? But the problem is that you actually could do that. So just to say that that's a real risk, and we regard it as a serious risk, and yeah, that's why we are in this field.
I mean, I agree absolutely. I mean, we've seen the Chinese government do climate engineering of a certain form already with a program employing tens of thousands of people where essentially they're trying to move moisture off the Tibetan plateau north onto the plains, which are drying out by various measures. And we also have that book by Kim Stanley Robinson, for those who like their climate fiction of a certain kind, where he has a scenario where it simply gets so hot in India and people die in such numbers that the Indian government, even without governance, decides to act. So, I mean, I think that is the fear. We've also had a question about something we haven't talked about yet, and I know you have done a little bit of work with a researcher called John Moore about physically trying to stop glaciers melting, what I think he called with seabed curtains, some physical way. Can either of you explain that briefly to our audience?
Yeah, I'll explain it the way that I understood it. I study gender studies, so I'm definitely not, know nothing about climate science. But so, yeah, the point is that we would build like these huge structures to support glaciers from underneath. So the problem with usually like the warm water currents hitting the glaciers from underneath is that they kind of destroy the glacier from underneath so that they melt from underneath and then the tops kind of crumble down.
And they slide off the rock.
Yeah, exactly. So these seabed curtains would not kind of support the glaciers themselves, but they would keep the warm water currents from kind of getting to the underbellies of these glaciers. And they would kind of direct that warm water away from the glaciers. So that would like slow down the melting of these glaciers, so it wouldn't be so catastrophic. Yeah.
We've got a couple more questions on the politics of it. And I think it was you, Annie, or one of you in the COP28 videos, you talked about the existing climate movement and the old the paradigm of many of the existing groups, which I found really interesting. Could you talk about that briefly? Because it was sort of pretty incisive what you said.
Yeah, I mean, how we kind of look at it is that we have this old climate paradigm that was born like over 30 years ago when we were in a completely different situation with climate change. And the old paradigm is about zeroing emissions and kind of hoping for the best. Okay, so it's like it doesn't really take, it doesn't really like the old paradigm doesn't state which like ecosystems we should save and like which ecosystems are essential and to whom, and you know, it's not about like actively intervening, actively repairing. It's just about cutting emissions and hoping for the best. And that was like a very, you know, valid paradigm. That was like a very valid way of approaching climate change about 30 years ago. But now we're in a situation where some of these collapses are already happening in like certain ecosystems and certain climate system elements. So how we see it is that there's a real need for a paradigm shift into this new climate paradigm that is about active repairing, active intervening, that is about climate repair, about reducing emissions, but also providing active support for the parts of the climate system that are already breaking down. So it's also like, I think what's at the heart of it is kind of like even like this really moral and emotional issue, which is that we shouldn't just like step back and kind of accept all the damage that can be no longer avoided by just cutting emissions. So the new paradigm is about not accepting that damage and about not being indifferent about the things that we can no longer affect by just emission cuts.
It's sort of having normative goals, which seem to be lacking in terms of, I mean, I said it's almost in the traditional climate movement, this triage, the things you'll save and things you won't save. And you just write off a whole lot of things because it's too difficult, rather than trying to establish a goal that could actually protect what's important. Another question, which you've responded to a little bit, I think, and that we've had two questions from Adam and somebody else about the response to what you've been saying. I think you mentioned, I mean, 10 years ago, you couldn't have, even 5 years, 3 years ago, it would be very difficult to have this conversation about climate repair and climate engineering. But it feels to me, as the physical circumstances change so quickly, that people are more open for this debate than they were. It feels like it's quite rapidly changing political territory in a way.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think that's unfortunately gonna, you know, increase, like that whole trend is gonna keep going. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't have imagined talking about interventions like 3 years ago. And that was because I didn't know about like climate science and I didn't know what the situation was. But even just like the fact that these conversations weren't really happening anywhere and no one was talking about them, like to me, climate activism was always about zeroing emissions and hoping for the best. Like it was always like this very straightforward thing. So kind of we are in very much like outside of our comfort zone, like having these discussions.
I think we all are.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, definitely. Yeah.
Another question from Bryony. Have you created any links with other groups who are also interested in this 3 R's approach, just not mitigation, but drawdown and cooling? Are you finding, I know you've done some work and you said there's a couple of people in the European Parliament. Can you talk about the engagement or pickup of these ideas outside of your home country?
Yeah, sure. So there are some groups. Of course, there are researchers in various universities and research institutions. Also, some of these smaller centers that are in the academia who are specifically looking into this problem. When it comes to political sphere, I don't know of any political parties or coalitions who would be actively talking about this yet. There will be at some point if it's up to us. When it comes to like NGOs or civil society, it's very small, but it's growing. So one of our friends, for example, set up this solar radiation SRM Youth Watch, solar radiation management youth watch, who are working on to create more debate and discussion around this. There are NGOs in United States, especially like Silver Lining, who are putting money in the research. I'm not just gonna, you know, there's no point of for me using time in like, you know, telling about the all of these organizations, but there are some. But the bottom line is that most are kind of indifferent or sideline. They are, most of the NGOs or climate movements are waiting for something to happen, some other people to take the lead. Mm-hmm. And then there are these these kind of small faction of people who are very opposed, very anti-research, who think that we are paid by fossil fuel industry and stuff like that.
I know that's not the case. You mentioned this briefly earlier. We've had a question from Sally. Has there been any engagement with the Sami group in Finland around this topic? I think you did mention this earlier with the Sami.
Yeah. We have, like, that was like from the get go. We knew that was going to be a big thing, because like, we're like a very important thing to do, because there was like one SRM research that, like, that's the first things that I remember reading about, like, SRM research, was like this Harvard Scopex thing that they tried to do in Sami land on like Sweden's side, and they had like no permits, neither from like the Swedish government or like locals. So that, you know, you can imagine how that turned out. There was no research, you know, a good thing that there wasn't. So that's what we've been doing. We've been in touch with Sami Youth Council, Sami Climate Council, and that's something that we really want to do. And in our like big conference, Arctic Momentum, that I mentioned earlier, we had a lot of like workshops and discussions talk around that whole issue, because like Finland does have, and all of like these Arctic countries do have, a long history of colonialism in the Sami land. So that is something that is really, really, really important to take into account in the research, and to be able for them to be participated in, like, from the get-go, not just answering questions that the research had already kind of formed, but to be part of the question forming, or like the whole process of like what we have been going to research.
And we also found great ally from the current president of Sami parliament, Birita Näkkäjärvi, with whom we are now planning to conduct this bigger workshop for the Finnish Sami parliament.
And a couple of questions the Finnish to conclude. One I should have probably asked at the beginning, I didn't, and this is from Alex. Could you describe the impacts of climate change that you can see in Finland?
Yes. Well, they are not too dramatic, to be honest, when in comparison to other areas of the world, of course. Well, the warming is a lot more here than in many other places when talking about degrees. So Finnish winters have warmed 5 degrees in the last, I don't know, 100 years. So that's a lot more than 1.5. which we are with the global average at the moment. Maybe the biggest things are like longer droughts and longer rainy seasons. Probably because of the jet stream disruptions. So every second year, every third year, there are some like bigger crop damages happening. But yeah, to be honest, they are not too bad at the moment in Finland in comparison. Yeah.
And finally, tell me about your plans for the next year. I know you're going to do some work in the UK and talk to people there. What's the plan?
That's right. Well, next month we are heading for UK, but also in the Brussels to talk to European Parliament people and the MEPs there. We are going to visit some universities, Cambridge, UCL, KCL in UK. Then we're going to write the paper with Jim Hansen, hopefully in the late spring, I think. But the bigger picture is for this year is to prepare experts to get into discussion. So the strategy goes a bit like this: to get like political action with climate intervention, we need public discussion because politicians respond to public debates. But before that, it's quite helpful to get like climate experts in academia, but also in government, like climate panels, expert groups, to get them updated in the discussion. Because when the public debate really gets bigger, it's quite good to have the people who government or who politicians will then consult to be able to be helpful in this situation. So that's the big picture.
Fantastic. Well, all power to your arm. And just before we go, in relation to the earlier question, the video of this session will be available. It will be available at breakthroughonline.org.au. And we already have a discussion paper on climate repair available on the Breakthrough site, breakthroughonline.org.au. And finally, on behalf of our audience, Annie and Anton, thank you for getting up so early. Thank you for a really engaging discussion. I hope we answered a lot of the questions that were done, and we thank you for sharing your important work.
Thanks, David. I hope so much. We were of any entertainment, at least. I found myself.
I'm not sure whether civilization is entertainment, but yes, you were, can we say engaging?
Yeah. But we should do this again because there's tons of topics that we didn't have time to cover.
Thank you. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, David. And thanks to your two guests. It was a wonderful conversation. And you'll find a link for Breakthrough Online in the show notes. That is, as David promised, where you'll find a recording of this conversation. Yes, once again, we're at the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for coming. It's been great to have you along. Now, I'd love you to follow this podcast because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. Also, please share this with your friends. Put it on your network. Let people know what's going on with the climate crisis. Let them listen to this podcast. Let them read the links. Let them think about the climate crisis and what their response should be. Also, I'd love to hear from you as to what you think about this podcast, so you can contact me via email at r.mclean7@icloud.com. Now, don't hold back, good or bad, please let me know. Now, my screen is still alive with stories about the climate crisis, so I'll put as many links as I can in the show notes, so please go there, check them out, and read them. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. You take care and stay safe.